We shall see in the next chapter that Oswald did use the name Hiddell and incriminated him, but as if, quote, Hiddell, unquote, were someone else. The superfluity of gun ads could even have been planted among Oswald's possessions, as some have argued his Hiddell draft card was. For our present argument, it is irrelevant. Both Oswald and, quote, Hiddell, unquote, whether one man or two or more, were apparently part of a sustained investigation into illegal and improper gun sales. This investigation, this last sentence again, for our present argument, it is irrelevant. Both Oswald and Hiddell, whether one man or two, were apparently part of a sustained investigation into illegal and improper gun sales. This investigation would explain Oswald's or Hiddell's desire for the wretchedly inaccurate and indeed dangerous Mannlicher Carcano, a gun which sold wholesale for as little as $2. The federal government and Dodd's subcommittee, as it happened, were concerned about, quote, so-called junk guns that foreign governments, in this case the Italian government, have found obsolete. The investigation would also explain the names and addresses of American Nazi Party officials found in Oswald's address book. The American Nazi Party in 1963 was being investigated by the U.S. government and the Dodd subcommittee for its mail order purchase of firearms. Indeed, I think the evidence presented here, the information presented here by Peter Dale Scott, certainly suggests the distinct possibility that Oswald's role as a government informant, whether it was as an industrial security informant, as hinted at by Professor Scott, or as a government operative working through a private contractor to trace gun sales and illegal gun sales, the evidence suggests that the eventual linking of Lee Harvey Oswald to the weapons that he supposedly used to kill President Kennedy and Officer Tippit was part of Oswald's undercover work in a different capacity. Indeed, I think the notion of Oswald as a lone nut or as a Marxist can be safely discounted, as we have indicated. Once again, I want to stress this is not a connection that I view as being etched in stone, but I think the available evidence, both the overly incriminating evidentiary trail linking Oswald to the gun ads and in turn to the Mannlicher Carcano that he supposedly used to kill Kennedy, and indeed the interest of the Dodd Committee in and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in the firms that Oswald was ordering weapons from, and indeed the proximity in time between his 127-63 purchase of a pistol and the 129-63 opening of the Dodd subcommittee hearings on illegal weapons purchases, the presence of a U.S. government motor pool in Adrian Alba's garage right next door to the William Riley Coffee Company. By the way, William Riley, Oswald's employer, a member of the Cuban or associated with the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban umbrella group, a very strange person to be employing the alleged Marxist Oswald. That equally strange connection, that equally strange proximity manifests itself throughout the strange story of Lee Harvey Oswald. But again, I note this because the assassinations of John Kennedy, which are not something that stemmed from the excessive presence of firearms in this society, whether or not one could deem that presence excessive, as well as the assassinations of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, have been used to press for gun control legislation. And indeed, as indicated in the article that I read a little earlier, President Clinton continues to make that very same connection. Given the presence of Senator Thomas Dodd in the rollback or liberation milieu, that explicitly fascist milieu underlying the assassination of John Kennedy, given the spurious connection being made between the excessive presence of firearms in this country and our political assassinations and attempted assassinations, whether the killings of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King or the attempt on President Reagan's life in early 1981, the role of Senator Thomas Dodd in the generation of gun control legislation is one that I think warrants investigation. Beyond that, I think there are some interesting questions to be asked and answered about just how long ago the disarming of the American population or the restriction of Americans' access to guns was contemplated. I do not think that there was an overall master plan for the establishment of fascism in the United States that was... I do not think such a plan was set forth in detail decades ago. I do think, though, and the historical evidence is quite clear, that many of this country's most powerful figures, industrialists, financiers, politicians, and national security people, were ardently pro-fascist. I think that at the end of World War II, very powerful elements in this country saw fascism as the most potent antidote to what they saw as the threat of world communism. And I think it is a distinct possibility, note the use of the term possibility, that a blueprint was established, perhaps not in detail, but an overall plan was established for eventually implementing fascism in the United States. I suspect that the follow-through on such a plan, if such a plan was generated, would have been conducted according to contingency arrangements. However, I think it is possible, I'm not saying it is, but I think it is a distinct possibility that the assassinations of the 1960s and 70s were conceived in the context of gun control and the eventual imposition of gun control legislation. I think it is more probable that the assassinations were used subsequently to justify gun control legislation. In other words, even though it appears that Oswald's ordering of firearms may very well have been under the auspices of his work as a U.S. government informant, perhaps working for the Dodd Committee through on contract, perhaps working for ATF, again, through a private contractor, even though it appears that the setting up of Oswald as the assassin was intimately connected to his work in his work in ordering guns, I do not think that necessarily, in other words, Oswald's, the framing of Oswald as an assassin is what I mean to say, certainly was connected with his work in ordering firearms, and I think Peter Dale Scott makes a very good case that, in fact, that work was probably being conducted on behalf of government bodies investigating the traffic in firearms. I do not necessarily think that the assassination itself was preconceived as an argument for gun control, although, again, that's a possibility that I hold open, just as I hold open the possibility, only the possibility, that there may have been an overall blueprint for the establishment of fascism in the United States formed decades ago, and I hold open the possibility that the disarming of the population may have been envisioned as part of that. I think that whether or not there was a long-term master plan, so to speak, or whether the push for gun control evolved over the years as a response to conditions or perceived conditions, I think there are some very serious questions to be asked about the American push for gun control in the context of the establishment of martial law, the establishment of dictatorship and fascism in the event of an economic collapse. And I think such a collapse is a distinct possibility. And indeed, I think the role of Senator Thomas Dodd in the rollback or liberation milieu that we looked at in RFA 37, we took a look at his connections to the ASC, the American Security Council, to the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation story, to the intelligence community. I think the role of Senator Dodd, first of all, in the gun control movement, also the possibility that Dodd himself might in some way have been connected with the actual manipulation of Lee Harvey Oswald as a patsy in the upcoming assassination of John Kennedy. Again, not a statement I'm making, but a question I'm asking. I think all of these questions need to be asked and answered. And one of the things that I find fascinating about Senator Dodd's connections to the rollback or liberation milieu, the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation story, the possible work of Lee Harvey Oswald as an ATF or Dodd subcommittee informant. One of the things that is so interesting to me is that Thomas Dodd was on the U.S. Nuremberg prosecutorial staff. He was also one of the individuals primarily responsible for the U.S. Gun Control Act of 1968, which used the assassinations of John and of Robert and Kennedy and Martin Luther King, which occurred earlier in that year, as justifications for the need for gun control legislation. All of this is to be considered in against some allegations that have been surfacing in gun control in firearms publications, as well as in some right-wing literature, that the 1968 U.S. Gun Control Act is based almost entirely on Nazi weapons control legislation from 1938. Now, again, I am not either endorsing this or dissing it. I have copies of the German Act, and I also have copies of the American Act. I do not have the translation skills to see whether or not the German is as close to the English as the proponents of this connection maintain. But in light of Thomas Dodd's connections to the rollback or liberation milieu, in light of his presence on the U.S. Nuremberg prosecutorial staff, which, as we have seen, had a lot of people who were awfully soft on fascism and who, in fact, in my opinion, wound up taking actions which are leading to the establishment of fascism in this country, Messrs. Story and Jaworski being two primary examples, I think the allegations of the firearms publishing industry and some of the right-wing literature need to be very seriously explored, because if in fact that connection is a valid one, if they are accurate, it casts a different light, I think, on the actions of Thomas Dodd in the 1960s. And indeed, it suggests the possibility that the disarming of the American people and this country's political assassinations and the establishment of fascism and the eventual elimination of population groups deemed undesirable in the event of an economic collapse, it suggests the possibility that all of these things may be connected. And indeed, I began the first installment of this broadcast last week by indicating that I felt there was a distinct possibility of connections between a number of different things that were cropping up in the news: the fluctuation of the dollar, the rise in interest rates, the push for gun control, the inveighing against immigration and illegal immigrants, and indeed one of the key pieces of legislation that Hitler based his eugenics policies on was a U.S. Immigration Restriction Act from the early 1920s. I think it is distinctly possible that all of these things are connected. I'm not saying they are, but I think a key piece of research has yet to be done. I think the allegations by the firearms publication industry and some right-wing literature of a close correspondence between the U.S. Gun Control Act of 1968, basically authored by Thomas Dodd, and passed largely as a result of concern over the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I think the allegation that is maintained by the right-wing literature and by the firearms publication industry needs to be very seriously explored. I think the implications are extremely grave. Research credit on the following goes to a listener. This is from Guns and Ammo magazine from May of 1983. This is an article that is entitled "The War on Gun Ownership Still Goes On," subtitled "Gun Control's Nazi Connection," and further subtitled, "Startling evidence suggests that the Gun Control Act of 1968 was lifted almost in its entirety from Nazi legislation. We must call for a full investigation and the repeal of GCA 68 now." And this was authored for Guns and Ammo's May 1993 issue by an organization called Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. Skipping down in this, we find JPFO, again that's Jews for the Preservation of Firearm Ownership, has hard evidence that shows that the Nazi weapons law of March 13, 1938 is the source of the U.S. Gun Control Act of 1968, GCA 68. One more time. JPFO has hard evidence that shows that the Nazi weapons law of March 13, 1938 is the source of the U.S. Gun Control Act of 1968, GCA 68. Adolf Hitler signed the Nazi weapons law. The Gestapo, the Nazi National Secret Police, enforced it. In Gun Control, Gateway to Tyranny, We present the official German text of the Nazi weapons law and a side-by-side translation into English. Even more deadly, a side-by-side, section-by-section comparison of the GC-68 with the Nazi weapons law. If you have this in your hands, no one can tell you that you're imagining things. I have seen it, and I've read it. Unfortunately, I can't translate the German for myself. That's why I'm not putting my 100% stamp of approval on it. I'm also not dissing it in any way. I think it needs to be examined further to see if it's true by someone qualified in German. Because if it's true, the implications are enormous. Continuing, the clincher. JPFO knows who implanted into American law cancerous ideas from the Nazi weapons law. The likely culprit is a former senator, now deceased. We have documentary proof, see below, that he had the original text of the Nazi weapons law in his possession 4 months before the bill that became GCA 68 was signed into law. The former senator was a senior member of the U.S. team that helped to prosecute Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, Germany, in 1945 and 6. That is probably where he found out about the Nazi weapons law. He may have gotten a copy of it then or at a later date. We cannot imagine why any U.S. lawmaker would own original texts of Nazi laws. To find out his name, read on. With this hard evidence in your hands and in your head, you can destroy cancerous gun control. You can challenge anyone who backs gun control. You can show them the Nazi ideas line by line. And indeed, they do present some evidence that Thomas Dodd was in possession of the German Weapons Control Act of 1938 before he helped to push through the Gun Control Act of 1968. Reproduced as a memo here from Lewis C. Coffin, a law librarian, to the Honorable Thomas J. Dodd, Chairman, Special Subcommittee to Investigate Juvenile Delinquency, U.S. Senate, Washington, D.C. It was that subcommittee that was investigating illegal weapons purchases through the mail, and Peter Dale Scott has indicated the possibility that Lee Harvey Oswald's work in ordering weapons was as a private contractor working, or as an informant working for either Dodd's subcommittee or the ATF through a private contractor. And obviously that work helped to set Lee Harvey Oswald up as the patsy. This memo reads, "Dear Senator Dodd, your request of July 2, 1968, addressed to the Legislative Reference Service for the translation of several German laws, has been referred to the Law Library for attention. In compliance with your request, and with reference to several telephone conversations between Miss Frank of your office and Mr. Fred Karpf, K-A-R-P-F, European Law Division, we are enclosing herewith a translation of the Law on Weapons of March 18, 1938, prepared by Dr. William Solyom Fekete, F-E-K-E-T-E, of that division, as well as the Xerox copy of the original German text which you supplied. The translation of the decree implementing the Law on Weapons of March 19, 1938, and the pertinent provisions of the Federal Hunting Law of March 30, 1961, is in preparation and will be sent to you as soon as completed. Sincerely yours, Lewis C. Coffin." So, again, note the allegation made by the firearms publication industry and by some right-wing literature that the 1968 Gun Control Act Senator Dodd was largely responsible for was based very closely on the 1938 Nazi weapons control law. Note Senator Dodd's presence on the U.S. prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg. Note his later presence in the rollback or liberation milieu, which underlay President Kennedy's assassination. Note his connections to the Bogdan-Stashinsky disinformation canard. Note his connections to the ASC. And again, note Lee Harvey Oswald's curious work in ordering weapons, possibly as an undercover informant. He may have worked as an industrial security informant, as Professor Scott has suggested, or he may have been working as an undercover operative through a private contractor, either for ATF and or for the Dodd subcommittee. Whatever is the case, both John Kennedy's assassination and the assassination of his brother Robert and the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968 have been used and continue to be used to this day, as evidenced by President Clinton's speech in Indianapolis a few weeks ago, as justification for gun control. Now, I want to emphasize again, I'm not a gun nut or some sort of wild-eyed right-winger. Hopefully veteran listeners to the program will understand that. Yet, in a country that I think is certainly politically imperiled and quite possibly economically imperiled, in a country which has martial law plans on the books, and given the obvious contradiction in the thinking of gun control advocates, they're citing guns as the source of crime, and guns are not the source of crime, the example of Switzerland being the proof positive in that particular regard. Given the possibility, and I think it's a certainty, although I would not state precisely, well, let's just say, given the distinct possibility, and I'm convinced that this is in fact the case, that some of the lone nuts who've been going off and blazing away at people and that have generated popular sentiment for firearms legislation, given the possibility, and I believe it is certain, that some of them are mind control jobs, some of them are patsies of the mind control programs and of the intelligence services, I think the possible implications of the allegation made here that the 1968 gun control law is based on the 1938 Nazi weapons law are immense, and they may very well, if that connection is accurate, if these allegations are accurate, it suggests the possibility of some extremely deep politics here, deeper by far than perhaps even Professor Peter Dale Scott would imagine under the circumstances. And again, although I'm not saying it is possible, I think it is possible that our assassinations and the push for gun control and the eventual elimination, what I think will be the eventual elimination of population groups who are deemed to be extra, I think these things may very well not only be connected, but they may constitute parts of what may have been a master plan for the implementation of fascism in the United States. Again, I'm not saying such a master plan exists, but I think such a master plan may exist, and I think it is possible that such a plan has existed for a long, long, long time. And those plans, would, again, might very well include such seemingly disparate things as population control, the economy, gun control, America's political assassinations, and such seemingly disparate figures as Senator Thomas Dodd, Lee Harvey Oswald, Robert Story, Leon Jaworski, Roger Pearson of the supported by the Pioneer Fund, and others who are advocating immigration restrictions and other measures to eliminate the burden on our society of so-called undesirable segments of the population. I hope I've emphasized it clearly enough. If not, let me reiterate that I am not suggesting that all of these things are hard connections, but I think they may very well be, and we need to check to see if, in fact, they are. What we're going to do now is listen to an archive show from September 25th of 1988. This archive show concerns the political pedigree of another person who has been centrally involved in the push for gun control, unlike Senator Dodd, who was central to the gun control movement in 1968 and before that. This individual is currently the head of the department. He's Secretary of the Treasury, and as such is in charge of not only the Secret Service, but also the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That man is, of course, Lloyd Benson. He was the vice presidential candidate in 1988 when I did this particular archive show. And Lloyd Benson has been centrally involved in the push for gun control legislation. I would also note that, as we shall see, Lloyd Benson has had profound connections to the Defense Industrial Security Command. That's an institution connected with Division 5, the Internal Security Division of the FBI. It has now, I'm told, been renamed the Defense Investigative Service. A number of observers have maintained that the DISC, connected to Lloyd Benson, was centrally involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, as well as the assassinations of his brother Robert and Martin Luther King and others. If, in fact, that's the case, and if, in fact, Professor Peter Dale Scott's speculations about Oswald as a possible national security informant are accurate, it raises some interesting questions about Lloyd Benson and his advocacy for gun control. He's at the center of the push for gun control, as I speak to you, on the evening of May 22, 1994. And in light of the use of America's political assassinations and attempted assassinations to justify gun control, I think an examination of Lloyd Benson's connections to the Defense Industrial Security Command, and in turn, the allegations of connections between that organization and this country's political assassinations warrant serious examination. So what we're going to do as the final element in tonight's prepared portion is to rebroadcast this miscellaneous archive show about Lloyd Benson, the Defense Industrial Security Command, and the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. This program was broadcast on September 25th, 1988. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Why don't you explain a little bit about the archive shows and what they're all about? I think it'll perhaps help people who are new to the broadcast to understand just what in blazes I'm talking about.
Indeed. The One Step Beyond broadcast, much as you hear them now, have been pretty much in their final form for quite a few years here on KFJC. And we found that as time goes on, like a hermit crab, we have a large shell of information that we have to carry around with us everywhere we go, and especially when it comes to discussing updates to stories that we've been following over a long, long period of time. We've discovered that we've spent a good portion of the broadcast just recapping old information and not getting much chance to really interpolate new data or to take calls and things of that nature, which our listeners have complained about when calling time has been short. So we initiated the archive broadcasts, and what the archive broadcasts are, unlike a regular broadcast where we will be dealing usually with a number of different issues and covering a variety of stories in their most recent incarnations, the archive broadcasts are dedicated to spending usually 4 hours, sometimes as much as five, to one particular subject and going into it in great depth and very assiduously noting all the reference materials, where they're from, where they can be found, and essentially making just what we call them archive shows that people can use as a library to refer to go back and dabble their toes in for 10-15 minutes here or there, or if they're really feeling strong and tough, they can get into for several hours at a time and make notes or do whatever they want to. Again, with the idea that we're not setting ourselves up as prophets speaking from on high, but we feel that if people are going to have a healthy dialogue with us, that they ought to have had the chance to see what it is that we've seen that's put us in the situation that we're in and has led us to the conclusions that we have come to. So we make this available, and we hope that you folks will make use of it. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this long diatribe, most of this stuff is...
It's not a diatribe, it's an explanation.
Yes, yes.
The people who watched the debates have already heard plenty of diatribes.
Several diatribes, I'm sure. But as mentioned, that this is stuff that comes up again and again and again. And, for instance, any one of the things, Turpin Wilson, that was just one of the Radio Free America archive broadcasts we just aired recently.
Last week.
The Secret Team. Has been coming up repeatedly in the last 7 years.
In fact, those of you who listened carefully, or those of you who taped it and are in a position to listen carefully, even if you didn't last Sunday, clever, clever people, can go back, play the tapes, and listen and hear the very same names that emerged so prominently in the Iran-Contra scandal, only that particular broadcast was done in late August of 1984, several years before that broke, more than 2 years before that broke. The point being not that we're prophets, but that anyone who has paid any reasonable amount of close attention to the developments of the U.S. national security establishment over the last decade plus could have accurately forecast what was going on, at least up to a point, and anticipated the Iran-Contra scandal. The archive shows, in a sense, are to allow people to build an information foundation, not only so that they can understand what we're saying at the moment, but so that they can begin to anticipate a little bit. One of my favorite little mini explanations of what's going on to people is that basically if they've ever sat through an episode of the old television series The Untouchables, which was recently made into a feature-length motion picture, they can understand the last 25 years of American power politics with no problem, because that's essentially how it goes.